Welcome to the Faith Element podcast for the August 25, 2019 session, focusing on Luke chapter 13, verses 10 through 17, People First. I'm David Cassidy.
I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm David Adams.
And I'm Bert Montgomery.
All right, guys, so we have this really cool little place downtown in Lexington, and it's called the Sunrise Bakery. I'll give them a little shout out. And it's not a big place, but they bake all their own breads. They also do pastries and such, and they make sandwiches. So Regina and I have kind of gotten into this ritual where we go, at least during the warmer season, we go downtown to the farmer's market. We'll get some fresh produce, and then we'll head over to the bakery, and we'll get a sandwich. Mm-hmm. Now, Regina typically gets the old world sandwich. It's like an Italian-styled bakery, and it, you know, it's very simple. It's just got the bread of her choice and some prosciutto and some cheese that's thin sliced and, you know, olive oil on it. It's great. But they have a sandwich called Just Make Me a Sandwich. In which case, if you order that, you're basically giving free rein to the chef or the sandwich maker to make whatever they want, and you will eat it. So it's gotten to be my habit to go in and order Just Make Me a Sandwich. And I have to say, it's been good every single time. It's been amazing.
Wow.
So, but I'm just curious, do you have any good sandwich stories? David, I think you have a sandwich story.
Okay, yes. Fair disclosure here. I just told a sandwich story. I'm not even going to give a shout out to some of my famous sandwich places, but recently I was preaching a sermon, and we'll just say the person who places my notes up on a board, because we don't use a pulpit, we read our sermon notes from a screen. It's in the back of the sanctuary. So I'm looking up and I'm reading off of a screen, and I have a tech person who will place my notes up there. They get them a couple weeks in advance, and everything's up in there and ready. Well, recently, this person happened to be eating a sandwich. And the sandwich kind of slid across the board they were using to present my notes. And soon the entire congregation was treated to my notes on the screens behind them, as well as the ones that I was looking at.
Oh, no.
And they were bouncing around. Oh. And I didn't realize it. I'm doing my best to preach a sermon, and I'm seeing eyeballs going back and forth like people just got hit in the head or something, because they're trying to read the notes and make sense of them. And then I realized I wasn't making sense of them either, and I was making up large parts of the sermon just to try to fill in because I couldn't understand what I was watching. And for a while, I chalked it up to, and yes, I'm on Facebook with these, so people will probably look at this and make comments, but I chalked it up to, well, maybe I'm just not having a good day and something's going on with my technology. And it wasn't until after the service that the person comes to me and says, there's a thing about the sandwich I was eating, and it kind of slid across the board, and it took us a few minutes to figure out what it was. And so if you saw things bouncing around, it was my fault because of my sandwich. And all I can think to say was, thank you for telling me that story. That's one of the best things I've heard all day. I'll probably be telling that over and over again for a while.
That really put you in a pickle, didn't it?
It really did.
I'm sorry.
How long have you been sitting on that?
Oh. I was working on it the whole time he was talking.
Wow.
Anyone have a story to beat that one?
I don't think I have any sandwich stories.
I don't either.
Well, you may hope you don't have one like David's. That,
right?
That could have been traumatic.
Could have been, but it was really fun. It got me thinking about sandwiches again.
Yeah, I guess so. That's easy to do Sunday before lunch.
Yes.
Now I'm trying to imagine preaching from notes that are up on a screen behind me. Like, that feels difficult.
No, it'd be great.
It's kind of cool.
I don't know.
Yeah, but see, this whole idea of having something turned in 2 weeks in advance.
Right? How does that happen?
How does that even work?
I know a guy who's really into deadlines. I mean, he's almost fanatical about them. And working with such a person can get you involved in turning things in on time, and sometimes early.
Well, hats off to that person.
Yeah. I hear he's really fanatical about it, though.
Well, we continue to be in Luke. And we have a very interesting passage to look at tonight. Bert, could you help us get started?
I'll try. Wow, this text, far from being a nice story of the healing of a crippled woman, as many of us remember it being told growing up in the church. Scholars and commentary writers agree that Luke is shining a light on a subtle but radical revolution, which will eventually get Jesus killed. Yes, a woman is healed, and that's wonderful. But we have to see the healing in the larger context. It happened in the synagogue, but not just at the synagogue. You know, the way we'll say hi to each other at ball games outside the stadium as everybody's tailgating or something like that. And not just in the synagogue, the way many of us purchase our peanuts and Coke and popcorn and concession stands underneath the stands, the seats. But it happened in the middle of the synagogue. Jesus is teaching in the synagogue, and he calls the woman to come to where he is, in the center of the main event. In a context in which being female meant being far less than being a man, being a female meant knowing and staying in one's proper place, Jesus calls this woman into everything that is not her place. In fact, some scholars suggest that her very infirmity represents her lowly status of being a woman. Her condition is attributed to a spirit of weakness. And this spirit of weakness has left her bent over and unable to stand straight. Jesus addresses her with a very general term, woman. And Jesus answers the leader of the synagogue by highlighting the unspoken implication that an animal is apparently more important than this woman. The response of the leader is a natural response from one whose practices, whose rules of how the game is to be played is being directly challenged, not just by words, but by direct action. Jesus doesn't hypothetically ask a question which then can be pondered and hypothetically discussed and argued. Jesus calls the woman to him while he is teaching in the synagogue. Jesus invites her to a place where everyone knows only men can be. Jesus invites her to a place that she knows is not her place to be, and he heals her on a day in which everyone knows no work, including healing, is to be done. And after the ruler, leader of the synagogue, rightfully corrects and scorns Jesus by reminding everyone present of the proper and agreed upon protocol and social norms, Jesus addresses not just this leader, but everyone there who accepts his point, the ruler's, the leader's point of view. Alas, you hypocrites. The old Baptist Broadman commentary defines hypocrites as those people who give attention to observance of religious rules, but who are not committed to justice and the love of God. Satan had bound the woman, this Broadman commentary states, acknowledging the institutional hierarchy of the times. But God liberated her. The spirit of the leader of the synagogue is not unlike the spirit that many have experienced within our churches today. As long as people recognize the social norms and the proper hierarchy and the authority of God's, well, men, who are in charge of God's ways, as long as everyone knows and respects their proper places, well, okay, I think that Stephen King's story, Misery, is a parable. Now, whether Stephen King knows this or not, but I think Misery can be seen as a parable illustrating many people's experience, well, with the church. When Nurse Annie Wilkes tells author Paul Sheldon in Misery, "I'm your biggest fan," well, if you've seen the movie or read the book, you know that Ann Wilkes is indeed an obsessed fan of author Paul Sheldon, but it's in the very worst sense of that term. She cares for him after a car accident that nearly killed him. She nurses him back to health, but with the intent of forcing him to write as she wants him to write, forcing him to write what she wants him to write, actually physically binding him and physically reforming him and physically deforming him into a Paul Sheldon that she wants him to be, into the Paul Sheldon that she needs him to be. It has nothing to do with Paul Sheldon being Paul Sheldon. It has everything to do with Paul Sheldon being Anne Wilkes' version of Paul Sheldon. Unfortunately, like the bent-over woman that Jesus invites in the synagogue, many of us know what Paul Sheldon in Stephen King's Misery feels like. We've been welcomed into a religious community that promises to care for us, that assures us that they love us, that in fact they are our biggest fans, but slowly and methodically they begin forcing us to fit into their pre-molded image, emotionally and spiritually attacking us and belittling us and undermining our self-worth and self-esteem until we become what this religious culture wants us to be, what the religious culture needs us to be, which has nothing to do with who we really are and nothing to do with whom God created us to be. And a few, like Paul Sheldon, even know what it's like to be hobbled by the church. And if you haven't seen the movie, look it up, Google it, and see what hobbling means. Because the attempts of churches to hobble some of us who have found their way into the sanctuaries, well, not so long ago, someone from outside the walls of the church mentioned that they were interested in some of the things that my church here in Starkville, Mississippi was doing, but they were so far removed from the church because of painful, deforming, crippling emotional and spiritual and psychological experiences. You know, there are more and more churches today that are reaching out and accepting and becoming places of healing, striving to celebrate the fullness of God's kingdom as it is being ushered in by this work of the Spirit, and that people are being healed from the deformities that other churches have done. Do you know anyone that's bent over like the woman in our story? Anyone that's been restricted and their shape, their emotional shape, their physical shape has been disformed because they've been cramped into a box or a closet that other people have pushed them into? Then we know what it's like, and we know what it's like to have been that woman in the middle of all these places and that she was forbidden to be lifted up and to be liberated and to be healed and freed.
So what it makes you wonder, where can you begin? We all know so many.
Mm.
You know, we've had so many experiences of this kind of thing happening in our religious experience and even in our experience of leadership. We've got these experiences.
Mm-hmm.
We see
mm-hmm.
it, and maybe this is another issue, is how many of these that we have and that we have seen that have come to us, that have caused us to say, well, you know, this is a part of church life, and it's something that over time it isn't, I guess it doesn't cause the pain that it should cause, and we grow to accept it rather than to bite back against it like Jesus does in this passage. Because it's congregations do those kinds of things. We know that.
Bert, that connection you made to the movie, that was powerful. I mean, if you've ever seen the movie, the minute someone says Misery, anytime I ever hear somebody say it, like, there's just chills. It's powerful. But the images that you drew connections to with this woman and with the ways that the church puts other people into boxes that they don't fit in. That's just, I don't have a lot to say. It's just kind of hanging on for me. Yeah. It's a powerful image.
And can they still be a church without their boxes? Because we cling to them so much. Well, I'm getting old and I tell the same stories over and over again. It kind of comes with the territory. I'm not old like certain other people I'm looking at right now, but
hey.
That's not me and Nikki, by the way.
Liz. Yeah. But I do that. A story that I like to tell over and over again, and it comes up whenever I hear people talk like, you know, what Bert was just talking about, is about the time we had a choir come visit us at church. And it was a special thing because, you know, we've got outside choir. It's Christmas time. And here's this choir full of people who are going to come and sing to us. And they're going to sing all these wonderful Christmas songs in a way, a different way than what our choir would do. Mm-hmm. And so it was going to be a very special time to hear what they have to sing. And at one point, and I did not know this going in, that this was a men's choir. And I mean a men's choir. And it's kind of controversial for a Baptist church to be bringing in a men's choir of that nature. But at one point, a soloist got up and sang In the Bleak Midwinter with a perfect voice and a perfect rendition. And with such deep emotion that it just makes you cry to even think about it, the way he sang it and the way his voice cracked just the right time. And he was so beautiful, a perfect moment. You wanted to go on forever. And he was crying at the end of it. And it wasn't until afterwards when we were talking and I asked, how do you do this? How can you bring so much emotion and care to this song? That he said, you know, I've been told I'm not allowed to be in churches anymore. You're the first church that's allowed me to come back and express my faith. And I didn't think I would ever have that opportunity ever again. And I was just so moved by that. But I could see there's somebody who was put in a box and told he couldn't be, and you know, it's not like he was a murderer or something, you know, or in jail or anything. He was just a normal guy and was told, no, you're not wanted here. You're not our kind of person. You can't be doing these kinds of things. You can't share your gift and be who you are here by so many people that he thought he would never get the chance to again. And when he was given the chance, it was just so beautiful. And it really impacted us heavily, but it impacted him heavily too, because we finally open that up and let him be himself and not keep him pressed into that particular mold. Just one of those ministry stories. I keep telling it because it just so stuck with me over such a long time. I ask a question in some notes for this. And I'm kind of curious about this, and it kind of goes in the same direction Bert was. So maybe it's the question that Bert's comments bring out, which was, why do we seem to have so many rules in church and congregations against doing wonderful things? I mean, what is so frightening about doing wonderful things that we seem to have a rule against it all the time?
Like healing a woman.
Yes.
Like eating a sandwich near the soundboard.
There we go. No, I think that rule might make sense now.
Yeah, that rule makes sense to me now.
Okay, yeah, that one's pretty good. You're right.
But when you read the passage, I love the way the passage ends. The entire crowd was rejoicing at all the wonderful things that he was doing. You know, so even after Jesus did all these things and liberated this woman and rose up and spoke back to the people who were stopping it from happening, it ends with saying the whole crowd was rejoicing at these wonderful things he was doing. So the crowd got it, you know, that, yeah. Oh, Jesus has done a wonderful thing here.
Right.
Which has got me questioning, well, how come we seem to have so many rules against doing wonderful things? You think a church would be the first place you want to do wonderful things.
Wonderful things are not easy to control.
Yes. And wonderful. Anybody can do them, educated or trained or not.
Right. I mean, I like the way you asked the question better. I had a negative way. I wanted to think about what causes those in power to put people in boxes. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's about control and power and access to the wonderful things. Not everybody gets access.
You know, and I need to clarify something I said in my opening. I used the term hobbling because that's what it's called. That's what it is in misery.
Yeah. In misery, yeah.
But it's a horrible thing, and it comes from, you know, slaves were hobbled, who were getting too uppity, or might be risk of, you know, trying to get free and go to the Underground Railroad and find freedom. They were hobbled. So it's a very physical, violent act of control. Yeah. And I just want to throw that in there because I'm just real sensitive to my white middle class privilege right now. And it's much worse than simply a fictitious thing in a movie.
It seems a common theme, though, in, I guess we call it our Western mythology, if you want to use that term, of people in power seeking to hold on to that power, being threatened by those who might do something different, and therefore trying to justify any horrible thing they choose to do in order to keep power, because the idea of people being liberated and people not being told what to do is so frightening and so threatening that they have to take action to stop it.
Yeah.
Even if it means just walking down, as in the scripture, walking down in the middle of the synagogue and calling them out and saying, hey, you're not supposed to do work on the Sabbath in a big, loud way.
Mm-hmm.
Or when he doesn't stop insisting he be crucified.
Yep.
That kind of, those in power, they don't start with crucifixion. They start like it started in the story today.
Yeah.
I think that as we think about this story, I think it can be a way that we can definitely, it's a story we can use to reexamine who we are and the rules that we set up in church. But I also think that as we look at the actions of Jesus and what that gave to this woman, the freedom that it gave, we can also say, one, where are we doing that in our churches and celebrating ways that we help other people find ways to freely be who they are? And also, what opportunities do we have to be like that? What ways can we embody that same kind of liberating grace for people in our communities and people that we come into contact with each day? Like the story of David with the choir.
Mm-hmm. I'm struck often by this. Even churches that say they do not abide by this, quote, rule, often do. And it comes up in the search process. Like when they have an empty pulpit and they need a new pastor, the rule that pastors should be male presents itself. And these are even churches that will say, oh gosh, you know, we're all for women in ministry. And would you be open to a woman as pastor? Well, we'd be open to that. But in practice, it's clear that there is a resistance. There is a fear. There is a, you know, what would happen if we did this? Would it feel right? Would it be wrong? And I can't help but feel like we are trying to constrain the Spirit of God. If the Spirit of God is moving to call a person to preach and to pastor, why in the world would this matter? You know what I mean? It's like we focus on superficial things and miss the deeper meaning of what's going on. The other place that, as I was listening to you guys talk, power is real in churches. And we may want to deny that it's not at work, but it is. Mm-hmm. And it's at work in other places too. So I work in academia now. Mm-hmm. And so at the school where I work, we have formed a partnership with an HBCU, with a historically black college. And suddenly, well, as of this fall, more than half of our student body will be black. And one of the things we noticed was that, well, I, as a white male, I have a really certain way of talking, and I have a certain way of writing. And so when a paper is turned in, does that paper get graded by the rules that I speak by? Is my English the right English, the best English? So we ended up rethinking the rules by which we would grade reading and we would grade writing and speaking. Because at the end of the day, the important thing is that these ministers be formed to do ministry in their communities and in their context. Right. So to take a black minister who is full of vigor and passion and excitement to speak and do the gospel in their community and make them speak like white guy. I mean, that's just wrong, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
But that's how, I mean, think about how papers have been graded for forever.
Yes.
That we have this idea that there's a rule about how it should be. And I know all the English teachers are screaming right now, but but the truth is there's something more important than that at work.
Yes. Right.
And so we want these ministers to be able to be the most effective preachers and teachers and leaders in their context that they can be. And that probably means they don't need to talk like me.
Yes.
So I mean, for us, that was just a huge thing. And we're having to figure out how to do that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it's not easy, but it is delightful to see these ministers blossom and to be affirmed for who they are and for their gifts. It's not something to be scared of.
And David, I just want to say, as a BSK graduate, that just fills my heart with so much joy and gratefulness, because you are offering healing and lifting up, helping a woman ascend in the middle of the sanctuary when it's not being done the right way, right? I mean, that's what you're doing. And wow, I'm so proud of my seminary. I mean, for a lot of reasons. There's a lot going on with Simmons and BSK that we should be proud of and thankful for.
But I guess part of why I mention it is I sometimes have people ask, you know, how could our organization or our church or our school become more connected with a black community or a black church or a black school? And the first thing that I tell them now that I wouldn't have known before is that you can't do this. You can't initiate this. It has to be initiated from the black community, because we carry too much power.
Right.
When we come in the room, we're in control. It's going to be our way in our space. And our rules apply. And we've got to be willing to not be in charge in order for this redemptive reconciliation to happen.
Yes.
And that is so hard for us to do. But I just want to say it is so rewarding. Not that we're good at it. We're stumbling along trying to figure it out. But God has been at work to teach us that there is so much more to what God is about than the boxes that we brought with us.
And I'm just going to, because I started with an image from a movie, so I'm going to say a different movie and end my talking with a different image from a different movie, and then I'll shut up for the rest of the thing. But Black Panther.
Oh, my.
Such a good movie.
Yes.
Black Panther. And the white United States government agent who had been out, you know, the government agencies out controlling the world, telling everybody how to do things, gets among these folks, and he just says, okay, this is yours. You tell me what I need to do to help. And he gets out of the leadership and into the role of servant. And that is just so powerful, because that, like you said, David, that has not been how the white church has typically responded to the black church since segregation ended. We want to tell everybody how to do things to be like us.
So, thank
you. What were you going
to
say?
Well, I was going to say, I think there's a connection to what we're talking about here in the text. I've been starting to look at ways that Jesus was an ally with people on the margins. So that's language that we kind of use today, right? How to be a good ally to different communities. That means that you are not a part of that community, but you are supportive. So you might be an LGBTQ ally, you might be a Black Lives Matter ally, or a people of color ally, you might be an ally for people who are differently abled. And so I have started to think about Jesus in that way. And so Jesus, in that setting of the story today, had the privilege. Jesus was a rabbi teaching in a synagogue. He was a part of, and whether they agreed with him or liked him or not, he had the privilege of being able to teach in the synagogue. And so with that privilege, nobody stopped him from bringing that woman to the center. If she had tried to come in on her own, she would have been stopped at the doors. But because he invited her in, he acted as an ally for this woman who had been so disenfranchised and so shut out of life and community. And he, as an ally, brought her back into community and gave her what she needed to then live into her fullness. And we got to be real careful there, because we're going to run into some of the stuff you were talking about where we don't want to think of like white saviors and things like that. Right. But there is a way to not take the credit and not use your power for yourself, but use it for somebody else.
Yes. To lift up another, to give the microphone to another, to right. put the spotlight on another.
Right.
Well, there are so many rules that we find ourselves following and thinking are rigid without even thinking about it. It's just part of how we have learned to act and to be. The wonderful thing about God's Spirit, I think, is the way that it breaks through these barriers. It breaks through these rigid areas to bring life and dancing and laughter and joy and newness. I think churches in so many areas are looking for newness. They're looking for the ways to reconnect with this world that so deeply needs the work of God in it. The work of God to bring us together, the work of God to heal us, the work of God to help us respect and treasure one another, to treat each other decently, to lift each other up. We can do this. And I think part of the excitement and risk of it is being willing to trust God, that following God in this loving way of being is harder than following a batch of rules, but it is so much more rewarding in the end. And I think we ultimately learn so much more about God when we take these risks. Thank you all for taking the risk to have this good conversation tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.